tonight's lecture, tonight's topic, is the historical background of the Babli. And unfortunately, unlike the situation in regard to Eretz Yisrael, we don't have a lot of outside material that's very pertinent to the history of Babel as far as Jews are concerned. However, that doesn't mean that an historical approach is going to teach you something that you don't know, or that you don't know at first glance. And so essentially what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about conditions in Babel, but more important, and I think much more useful, I want to talk about what it means to approach something historically and what you can learn from that kind of approach. And clearly, there's something, you know, I'm going to try to convince you that this is legitimate, and also that there are important kiddushim, things that that you can learn about the Babli that we haven't yet learned, because we ignore information that is there. There's data there that is just basically ignored, because we're not interested in the kinds of questions that that information can tell us. As a matter of fact, some of it we just don't want to know. I don't know who we are in this case. I mean, I know who we are. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it goes to you, but, you know, if it does, I hope to convince you otherwise. And if it doesn't, I hope to teach you, to tell you something that you didn't know before in any case. Now, when I say history, I mean two things. The second is going to be most of the lecture. The first thing is what everybody else means by history. And that means, you know, what do we know about the political events, the economic circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. This kind of thing. That's history. And that usually comes to us from outside. The Gemara, the Babli, is not particularly interested in giving us history. It's interested in halakha, it's interested in musar, things like that. It's not, you know, and whatever it gives us of historical importance is just agav orcha, you know, just by the way, as you're telling us something that you know, that's considered to be important, we'll tell you something else. So, for example, one of the most important dates in Babylonian history is the year 226. And I suspect I see some blank faces. As a matter of fact, I think I see a lot of blank faces. What happened to 226 that's so important? Anybody know?
The compilation of the Talmud?
No, not in 220. Well, that's not very far from that, but I mean in Babel, what happened? What happened was... No, Rav came a little earlier. No, what happened was that a new dynasty took over. The Sasanian dynasty took over from the Arsacids, or the Parthians. And that meant there are all kinds of things that happened, and you can trace what happens through a lot of sugyot. But the Babli nowhere tells you that that happened. The only thing they talk about is when the Chaveri came to Babel, meaning when the pagan priests, you know, the Zoroastrian priests became more active. That it talks about, but it certainly doesn't give you a date for it. Now, we'll see in a number of contexts where this date is very important. Let me just talk a little bit about what happened before and after that time. Before that time, you had the Parthian or the Arsacid dynasty, the Parthian regime, which basically was more interested in maintaining a defensive foreign policy than it was in internal government. So therefore, the Jews were left to their own devices. They could govern themselves however they wanted to govern themselves, and nobody cared. As long as they didn't make any, you know, didn't make any agreements with the Romans, or didn't let the Romans come in, and so on and so forth, which wasn't very likely, they didn't care. That's the Parthians. The Sasanians, at least the first two rulers, you know, were very different. They were much more gung-ho. Think of Newt Gingrich. They were also gung-ho in religion, and they want to, for the first time in ever really, they really wanted to convert people to their religion. There's a big difference. And they meddled in Jewish internal affairs. They wanted to run the communities, which the Parthians had not. So you see how things changed. Of course, as Newt Gingrich is going to find out, and that has nothing to do with my political affiliation, this happens to be the way of the world, the revolution is going to die down. That's the way what happens to revolutions. And so after two reigns, after Shapur, Shavur or Shavur, I don't know how you pronounce it, in yeshivas it's not much of anything. But at any rate, after his reign, things quieted down again. And even already in Shavur or Shapur, as it is in Persian, even in his reign, even though he was the second monarch in that dynasty and still gung-ho, he was already making accommodations with the Jewish community, as we'll see. But, as I said, if we were looking for a date to date this in the Bavli, we wouldn't manage to really get to something, very, very precise. On the other hand, this kind of date, as far as the Jewish community is concerned, is hard to come by in general. In other words, even when we have, as we do have, inscriptional material in Pehlevi in Middle Persian, it's not going to give it. It usually doesn't tell us about anything that we really want to know about the Jewish communities of that time, and certainly in Babel, which was the center of Jewish population. From both sides, we have a difficulty with what we have in the Babli. Well, on one hand, the Babli isn't terribly interested in general history, and on the other hand, the Persians aren't terribly interested in the internal dynamics of the Jewish community, at least not recording it. When the Sasanians came in and they wanted to control things, that's one thing, but they certainly didn't give us records. And of course, there are a lot of questions in general when it comes to ancient history, on the other side of the line, even the Roman Empire, where you do have documentation, you do have histories being written. Even there, the kinds of information that we want to know about, we don't have, because they didn't have it. In other words, now, if you want to research some topic in 20th century American history, 19th century American history, even European history, you go to the archives. We don't have archives. And the archives in the Roman world didn't have the kind of information that we would look for. So, for example, their statistics are impossible to come by, really. Any really, real meaningful statistics. We would not want to know something about economic activity. The business cycle in the Roman Empire. go look for the archives, go look for, they didn't maintain that kind of information to begin with. The information never existed, so how are we going to find out about what's going on, 2,000 years after the fact, when they themselves didn't know? When you consider the fact that historians, where you do have a lot of information, for example, let's say 19th century Europe, disagree among themselves about the proper interpretation of all the information that you have, consider when you don't have the information. Okay, so there are there's severe limits on what you can do with an historical approach if you take the conventional historical approach. Although, as I said, that one fact of 226, as we'll see, comes up a couple of times and enables us to understand sugyot that we might otherwise not understand as well. That's one kind of information, political information, dynastic information. Information about wars, we'll see that too. There's another kind of information, and that is what's generally called realia. In other words, how people live day to day. Anybody here ever learned Masechet Kelim in Tarot? No? Well, it's 30 chapters long. The first chapter is very nice. The next 29 are a list of Kelim, all kinds of vessels that were used in daily life. Tremendous source for if you want to know something about daily life in Eretz Yisrael in these centuries. Of course, you have to identify the vessels. And that of course is a problem. In other words, go explain to somebody, how a Shabbos clock works. I mean, I don't know how it works, but and even without something that's so technical, go explain something that is so common that, you'll instantly recognize it, but you have to set it down in words. Describe a fork. Things like that. And that's what I want to start with on top on page one here. Describe a door. And a door is, here's a door. Everybody knows what a door is like. Presumably the door hasn't changed very much in 2,000 years and 3,000 years. And yet, there are things that everybody knew about doors that we don't know about doors. I mean, doors in the ancient world. So take a look here. There's a Tosefta, Tarot, Karchet, Rabbi Shimon, Omer, Amoseh Mavtech, La'am Ha'aretz, Abayit Tameh. Of course, Am Haaretz is somebody who's not careful, with Tuman Tara, and so therefore, if you let him in your house and you're a chaver who is very concerned about these things, you know, he's going to touch something, he can be metameit, make it tameit, so on. So if you give a key to the house to an Am Haaretz, you can assume that if he will go into the house, because you've given the key, he has your permission, so he can wander around the house. He's not worried that you're going to suddenly come in and chuck him out. Yeah. And I'm asking somebody who's not, as I said, somebody who's not careful about Tuma and Tara, with ritual purity and impurity.
Could that be a Jew?
A Jew. A non-Jew doesn't. Yes, right. That's how it's defined. Absolutely. That is halakha, that in the Mishnah, that is how it's defined. We're not talking about how much he knows. That you know, that's one of the other thing he's not careful about maaser. No, we're not talking about knowledge here. We're talking about how careful he is with certain things like maaser, giving, you know, tithing his crops. And the other thing is he's not. I'm switching to the other side of the line to make a point. This kind of information is not available about Mavel. I'm going to talk about doors in the Roman Empire for a moment in order to make a point. Okay, so we're talking about here, the Mishnah, the Tosefta says that if you give an Am Haaretz entrance to your house, you can assume that everything he's going to touch is going to be tamei, because you know, he has permission to wander wherever he wanders. You know, if he didn't have permission, then he might be worried that you're going to come in immediately, and he does, you know, he'll go in and come out. So masalo achitzon v'lo masalo apnimi. If you give the key to the outer part of the house, but not the inner part of the house. So of course the part that he can get to achitzon tamei v'apnimi eino tamei ela ad mekom shehu yachol lifshot et yado v'liga. Now in other words, he can, as far as he can go, stretch his hand in and touch from the place that he's allowed to be. That circumference. Anything within that circumference is tamei. Otherwise, it's not. Now, what does that mean?
You're not talking about a courtyard.
No, we're talking about an outer room and an inner room. Now, the question is, how is he getting his hand in? In other words, he gets into the inner room, the outer room, and there's a locked door there. So how does he get his hand in? Here's where we're talking about how doors were constructed. And you'll see that the Rishonim and Achronim have a lot of problems with this kind of, with associated kinds of Mishnayot. This is a Tosefta. Let's take a look at one other source, a Mishnah in O'alot. Says, right, that's the second paragraph here. Chalon shehi la'avir, shi'ura melo mapdeach. If you have a window, this is not talking about a door, but it's talking about a window that is made for air. So the shiur, and I don't want to get into the technicalities of Hilchot Tumat Met, but the shiur has to be the opening of a drill bit of a certain drill that they had in the Bet HaMikdash. If it's that large, then the Tumah of Tumat Met, the dead body, has Tumah, which goes throughout the house, and it can go into the next house. If there's a way for it to go through, if there's that amount, it then can go through. Or if you have a bayit, it's next to the door, that too. But again, I don't want to get into the technicalities. But take a look at Gimel.
Excuse me,
Mabdeya.
What's
that? It's a key. Hachor shebadelet, the hole in the door, shiuro melo egrof, the shiur that the tumah can come through for tumat met. The tuma that a dead body that is associated with a dead body has to be a fist's amount. That's according to Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tarfon says that tefach by tefach in three dimensions. That's the minimum amount. Again, there's a lot to be talked about these halachot, but that's not the point here. What's this hachor shebadelet? What are we talking about when we talk about a hole in the door? So if you take a look, for example, here I have a few quotes here, Perush HaMishnayot HaRambam, Im Haya Nekev V'Delat HaBayit, if there's a hole in the door. A hole can be made, presumably, by itself. The door splits, or something else, you know, the wood dries, there's a hole in the door. Or Tiferet Yisrael says, Nireli Shuchor She'asah Uman B'Sha'ah She'asah Delat. In other words, while the door was being constructed, You need the man, the artisan, the door maker needed a hole in order to go on both sides of the door somehow. Ready, presumably the door was hung, and he had to do things, whatever it was, and he made that hole. Midahayat sarichah nakev or lenekev bimlachto lefisha. He needed it for that while he was working, and he never bothered to fill it up. So the hole remained. What you're talking about is something we're going to talk about next week. That is, you're right. That's a Gemara in Shabbat Hey Amud Aleph. Will the Tana go to such trouble to tell you with such an outlandish? However, if you don't have anything else to explain it by, then you remember something else. We think of things. I mean, look at this beautiful room. Look at this beautiful door. It's absolutely finished. It wasn't necessarily that way, in ancient times. It's just like if you've seen these pictures of 19th century Jews in Eastern Europe. You see people crumpled and rumpled, in other words, dry cleaning wasn't yet known, and people, right now we're much spiffier than people used to be. And here too, our doors are spiffier too, okay? So you can have some kind of an explanation like that. The Rambam could say, well, you know, it's not really that much of a problem. It's not so unusual to have a hole in the door. Now, Reb Chanoch Albeck in his Perush HaMishnayot says basically the same kind of chorim ustakim, holes and cracks, elu nasim elehem, when these are made by themselves, meaning the wood dries and it cracks, it splits, and we've all seen this. I guess, although as I said, things are spiffier today. Now, but what's going on here? What's going on here is very interesting. And here it's just a question, there's no big chokmah here. You have to know how Roman doors were constructed. And the Mishnah, of course, Mishnah is contemporary with Roman doors, and it knows how Roman doors were constructed. Unfortunately, this is the kind of thing that everybody knows, so nobody thinks of transmitting. Okay, when you talk about Masorah, you're talking about things that people are consciously considering as important information to transmit to the future generations. But they don't necessarily transmit things that everybody knows. If you learn Shulchan Aruch, and you see various discussions about glasses on Shabbat, you have to know how they wore glasses. Most in the 19th century and before the 19th century, they didn't have earpieces on their glasses. They had a pince-nez, in other words, most often people who wore glasses carried the glasses until they needed the glasses. Okay, this is a very simple little thing that you don't necessarily transmit because everybody knows it until the style changes and you have to know it because the halakha is based on something that is no longer the style. Same thing in Hilchot Tisha B'Av, there's a whole question about, gihuts and so on, how do you iron clothes and so on. You have to know something about the way things were done in earlier times. So from that point of view, technology, knowledge of the history of technology is important. Now, in this case, there's a very simple explanation to all of this. And how do we know it? We know it because they found doors in Herculaneum and Pompeii, those two cities that were buried under the ash of the volcano Vesuvius. Okay, and now we have, they've dug them out, and archaeologists have had a field day, and that's one of the things we learned. You know, very pedestrian kind of thing, doesn't seem to be very important, and yet it will enable us to understand this Mishnah and this Tosefta much more easily. Did I do it right? Or the other way? No, it's this one. There, like that. This is called a foramen. And every door had one. And the purpose is very simple. You have to know something about Roman keys before you understand what you need a foramen for. I'm not going to go into the whole thing, but in order to open a door, the key, the lock wasn't on the inside. The lock was on the outside, it was on the inside. You had a bria, you had a bolt, and the key was usually, well, there are different kinds of keys, but usually like an elbow key, like this. And you had to put your hand in, put it into the lock, and move the bolt. You couldn't do it from the outside, you had to do it from the inside. And so therefore you had to have a way to get inside without yet opening the door. And so you had this thing called a foramen, which was a door that was big, a hole in the door big enough to put your hand through so that you could then use the key. Okay? That's how Roman doors were constructed, and that's the door, the kind of door that the Mishnah is talking about. Very simple, it's not a slit, it was intended, and this is the standard Roman door. And you know, that's the kind of information that comes into the area that I spoke about, I mentioned before, called Re'alia. Do we have a... okay. Not yet. This is especially going to be good when we start analyzing Sugyot, because there are all kinds of diagrams that will be very useful.
Okay. So Tiferet Yisrael didn't know it,
right? He didn't know it either, because we're talking about something that's only known in the 20th century, or in the 2nd century, you know, or the 3rd century, but after, you know, after a while, they didn't make doors that way anymore.
The closest one is Rambam.
Yeah, right, exactly. The closest, I was thinking about that, you know, the closest one is the Rambam, right, which I think is only proper. Okay, now let's take a look at some sources that are more overtly, more usually historical, the kind of things that we talk about, we think about when we talk about history. Here's a little sidelight, and not well-known sidelight, that I think will tell us something about, number one, the personalities involved, and also possibly how you approach this kind of problem the Jewish community had in 226. Which is to say, you now have a gung-ho government that wants to take over, really take over, Jewish internal affairs, and what do you do? You know, how do you work with them, or don't work with them? How do you resist them? What do you do? After all, moving to the Roman Empire wasn't much of a bargain either. You know, the Romans certainly interfered in Jewish internal affairs, and it got worse under the Byzantine Empire. Not that they would have known it in 226, but you know, they certainly knew that things were worse. And they were worse in Rome than they were in Babel. Even with the gung-ho Sasanians at the beginning, it was still worse in Rome. So take a look here, Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud. Antoninus Shamshei Lerebi. Antoninus, you know, one of the, let's say it's Antoninus, and we won't go into the problems of Roman history, which isn't the topic tonight anyway, but he was, of course, Rebbe's great friend, and certainly Rebbe served the Roman regime as well as he could within, you know, the bounds of his responsibilities to the Jewish community. So it said, the Gemara says, Antoninus served Rebbe. And then it says, Ardakan, which is almost certainly Ardavan the fifth, who was the last Parthian Persian ruler, Shamshei L'Rav. He served Rav, because Rav is the great first generation Amora, a Talmud of Rebbe, who came down to Babel and established the yeshiva. By the way, don't think that there was no Torah in Babel before he came. There were yeshivot, Shmuel was there. We have a lot, you have all kinds of evidence that for centuries before, there was a flourishing Torah community in Babel. And as a matter of fact, this is not an historical source, but nevertheless, you know, and I recommend to everybody, whether you're interested in history or not, take a look at Midrash Tanchuma Noah Gimel. Beautiful history, the yeshivot in Babel. Again, in the early years, you might wonder if it is really history. Nevertheless, it's beautiful, beautiful stuff. But at any rate, when Rav came down, he certainly did, he did a lot for learning in Babel. But at any rate, aside from that, he seems to have had some special relationship with Ardavan the fifth, who was the last, as I said, the last Arsacid ruler. And so the Gemara then says, Kishkiv Antoninus Amar Rebbe Nitarda Kavila. So Rebbe mourned Antoninus, the Roman emperor, when he died, and he said, the bundle has been split. And when Ardavan died, Rav said the same thing. So in other words, he said the same thing about his emperor as his teacher, Rebbe, had said about his emperor. So here we see that there was a particular relationship that Rav had with the outgoing regime. And so you begin to see when you have the next source, Yomah Daf Yud, Amar Rav, Atida Parash, if you call Biad Romi, you begin to see where Rav is coming from. He says that at some in the future, Paras, Persia, is going to fall into the hands of, in other words, be conquered by Rome. In other words, presumably this, he's saying this sometime after 226. By the way, Rav was Niftar in 248, so somewhere between 226 and 248, you know, he was talking about the Persian regime and predicting that they would be conquered by the Romans. And so Amrulei Rav Kahana Rav Asi L'Rav, so Rav Kahana was certainly one of his Talmidim, and Rav Asi said to Rav, Banoye Biat Satore, do you mean that the builders of the second Beit HaMikdash are going to be conquered by the destroyers of the second Beit HaMikdash? Because after all, it was the Romans who destroyed, they're the ones who did Kurban Bayit Sheni. And it's Paras who encouraged the building of Bayit Sheni. So how is that fair? You know, Rav Kahana is saying that the builders should be conquered by the destroyers. So Amaluhu, so Rav says them in, yes, Gzeirat Melaki. This is what God decided. It may not seem fair, but that's what he decided. Ikadami, but there's another report of what Rav said, and here we begin to understand the historical context. And as I said, understanding the historical context, it gives us a more of a zip to what the Gemara here is reporting. So Amalahu, others say, he said to them, Inu nami hakasati Beit Nishta. They too, meaning the Persians also, didn't destroy the Beit HaMikdash, but they destroyed synagogues. Okay, they destroyed Batei Knesiot. And so therefore, if they're conquered by the Romans, it's not so terrible, because they too are destroyers. So apparently, excuse me, this is Rav saying it, right? And apparently it means during the beginnings, the early reign of the early rule of the Sasanians, they were so gung-ho that they may have destroyed some Batei Knesiot also. That's the whole point. He was friendly with the outgoing, the Ardavan V, the earlier regime, the earlier dynasty. You now have a new dynasty coming in, who, as I said, were gung-ho, they were religious fanatics also. And so you see the context against which he's talking. You know, it's like trying to understand, you know, what various religious leaders have said in the last 50 years about Germany without realizing what Germany did during World War II. Okay, so in other words, that's really what's happening here. You have to understand 226 was a really a tremendously a real watershed in Jewish history in Babel, and this reflects that. So once we know that, we also can say something about, you know, when Rav said Kishtiv Ardavan, you know, when Ardavan died, he said Nitparda Chavila, and we also can see when he talked about Batei Knesiot being destroyed. And Then there's a Braita, an Amoraic Braita, it says Tanya Nami Hachi. We also learned a Braita, Atidav Paras, Shetipol Biad Romi. And that's what the Braita says in the Gemara. And, you know, Asa, Chadid, Satri, Dachmei, Kanishta. One, because they destroyed synagogues. And also, Biyod Gizerat Melachu, Sheyiflu Bonim, Biad Sotrim. Which is basically a restatement of what we had just before. Now, more than that happened, as I said, they were really gung-ho about their religion. That means two things. If they could make converts, they would. And meanwhile, even if you didn't convert, you had to be very careful to show proper respect to their religion. Okay, there was no putting Hanukkah menorahs at City Hall. Not in the early Sasanian regime. So you have in Shabbat Daf Mem Hei there. They once Rav was once asked a she'ela. He was asked, you know, a halakhic question. Ba'ba'u minem the Rav. Can you carry away a Hanukkah menorah, a Hanukkiah, on Shabbat, because of the chaverei, meaning the pagan priests, the Zoroastrian priests, who of course were fire worshippers, and they didn't want Hanukkah menorahs displayed, And so therefore you might have to move them away, even though they're Mutsar and so on. So he was asked about that. And he said to him, Shapidami, that's very good that you do it. In other words, you've got to keep this private, because you know you light it in public very quickly, and then you move it away from the window, from the door. You keep it out of sight, because you got to be careful about these Zoroastrian priests who are very, very, as I said, gung-ho about showing, you know, that the Jews have to show proper respect to their religion, and they can't misuse fire and stuff like that. And so here too, that all must date from that period, 226 to 248. Even 248 would still have been a problem that at the time. Now, Shmuel, who was Rav's contemporary and who was Niftar about 6 years after he was, meaning he was Niftar probably in 254. The question exactly. There are other reports that have him dead and dying in 252, but in this area. Apparently had a different policy, and also had different relationships, which also tells us something about, you have to contribute to the Democrats and to the Republicans, because you never know when you're going to need one or the other. So Rav had his relationship with the Persian court, with the Persian king Artavan V, and of course we know that Shmuel had his close relationship, or at least some relationship, with Shapur the First, who was, as I said, the second of the dynasty, and known as a conqueror and so on, fought many wars, this kind of thing. As a matter of fact, in later generations, Shmuel was called Shapur, or Shabur. In Gemara it's a bet, even though in Persian it's a pay. At any rate, he was apparently so closely associated with the Persian king that he was known by the Persian king's name. That seems to be the case. And so what happens here is, and I apologize for, yes?
How long the two rulers lasted?
Shapur lasted for about 40 years, and he died in the 260s, I think. I can tell you exactly. A Mishnah Gittin that says, Kol Ashtarot Ha'olim Ba'arka'ot Shel Ovdei Kochavim. All deeds, all legal documents that come out of Gentile courts, afal pi shechotmeihem ovdei kochavim, even though the people who sign them are goyim, sherim, they're still valid. Chutz migitei nashim b'shifrei avadim, except those two kinds of documents, meaning divorce documents or documents that relate to a slave being freed, those are not. And Rabbi Shimon says, Omer af eluk sherim, okay, lo huskaru ela bizman shenasu behedyot, as long as they were done by an expert, Gentile lawyer, they're okay. And then there's a Gemara, the Sugya talks about, does that mean every kind of document, even if it's a sale document, okay, but what about a matana? You're giving somebody a gift, so there's no money that's that's being passed from one hand to another. Yeah, I'm at the bottom. Hedyot, somebody who is not, who is not an expert in there. So you have the Gemara here, then talks about any kind and so on. And it points out that if it's a matana, if you're just giving somebody a gift and you're not requiring any money for the transfer, so then the deed itself is the document. That's the only thing that effectuates the transfer. Are there courts competent to do that according to halacha? And so Shmuel says at the very bottom here, and as I said, unfortunately my printer cut it off for some reason after I reformatted it this morning. And I didn't notice it until after this was Xerox. He says that this is one of the places that he makes this famous klal, dina de malkuta dina. Okay, in other words, that they do have the right to do this, even in Bava. Now, clearly what he's doing is also enunciating a policy. He's saying, we're having our troubles with the Persians, but for certain purposes, dina de malkuta dina. Okay, we have to pay our taxes as long as they're not specifically levied on Jews. The Rishonim have There's a lot to talk about when we talk about the klal of dinah d'malchutah dinah, but certainly in a simple way, we have to cooperate with the government. Okay, so he's enunciating a certain policy. He's not saying, as Rav said, that the Persians are going to fall into the hands of the Romans. Okay, he's counseling, suggesting a policy of accommodation. Okay, so if you see it against the historical background, you see the difference between Rav and Shmuel. And of course, Shmuel's policy prevailed and was successful, because after this, things quieted down considerably. And for centuries thereafter, at least for a century thereafter, the Jews didn't have any trouble from the Persians. They regained a good deal of their self-government, and you don't hear about the problems that you hear about before. And that's even when, and this is very interesting, it just shows you how successful Shmuel was. The Christians always had a lot of trouble from the Persian government. You know, there was a large Christian minority in Persia as well, in Babel particularly. The Nestorians and so on, there's a lot to talk about there too, because they're one of our sources for history, because they do have chronicles. And they also had schools. They had things, you know, the counterpart of our yeshivot, or at least the Amoraic yeshivot. They had church schools. And they were always suspect by the Persian regime. They could never do anything right. Why? For a very simple reason. Because, and this is especially after Constantine, after 325, when the Roman Empire became Christian. So then to be a Christian in Persia meant that you were a member of a foreign religion that was, you know, the arch enemy. You know, so the Christians always had it more difficult in Persia than the Jews did. At some time, at this brief period when the Sasanians came in, they both had it equally bad. But pretty soon things calmed down. The Christians still had trouble. The Jews generally did not have trouble. It doesn't mean always. There were reports there's a Cartier, but that's also from that period where he tried to proselytize, try to convert other people. But that too is in that same period before Rav died. So here you have, as I said, now this, does this help us? Is this of tremendous help? Let's not overstate the case. This is not of tremendous help in understanding the Suyot or these Memrot. In other words, we know that Rav is against, we know Shmuel is more for, but to know the exact historical circumstances helps us, you know, gain a certain clarity in the Suya. Not that we won't understand the Suya without it, we will. But again, it helps us clarify and be more precise about it. We know the dates and so on and so forth. And by the way, please note, aside from 226, I don't have any external dates. The Persians certainly and the Christians certainly did not preserve the date that Rav was Niftar or the date that Shmuel was Niftar. We have that from internal sources. We have that, among other places, from a very important source that you should all be aware of, called Igeret Rav Shira Gaon. How many people have heard of it? Okay, so this is one of the most important sources. And one of the things he gives us is many of these kinds of dates. So now, and remember, these are not dates that are in Gemara. These are dates that he had in the yeshiva archives. Okay, and so, you know, he's passing them along to us. And we ought to pay attention. Most people don't pay attention, but it helps us, as you see here. These are dates that are easily come by, more or less easily come by. And they're from Jewish sources, from an impeccable source. There are some questions because the manuscripts differ slightly in what the date is. There's also Toldot Tanaim Vamarim that also somewhat different, Seder Tanaim Vamarim. But nevertheless, by and large, we know these dates from Gaonic sources. Yes, sure, they were contemporaries. Exactly. That's why I said you've got to give to the Republicans and to the Democrats. You know, in other words, Rav maintained good relations with the Parthians, with Ardavan the Fifth, and Shmuel with the incoming regime. I mean, that's perfect. You know. Excuse me. The dustbin of history. We're not talking about a whole people. We're talking about a dynasty. We're talking about a family, a large family. Think of the Saudi royal family. When they're finally, you know, pulled from power, what's going to happen to them? Well, they'll be on the Riviera. You know, I mean, you know, I don't know where the Parthians went, but, you know, they went wherever they went. We don't hear about them anymore. I presume some of them were killed, some of them got away, you know, however it happened, you know. The Persians? The Ayatollah. Totally. They're the same people.
Yeah.
No, not Iraqis. That's the whole thing. Persia was an empire that included Iraq. Okay, so Babel is Iraq. And so the Jews were concentrated in Babel. They were not in Persia very much. Okay, and the Christians were also in Babel, not particularly in Persia. But they ruled that whole area. So, you know, Iraq, you know, that's Babel. And Babel has, you know, a very long history of Torah. I mean, we're talking about thousands and thousands of years.
So the Iraqis of today are not Persian?
No, well, that's a different, no, not at all. And but they're Arabs anyway, mostly, you know, right. No, the Persians are not Arabs. I'm not saying the Iraqis are Arabs, the Persians are not. Yeah. Look, the Persians speak an Indo-European language, they don't speak a Semitic language. In other words, Iranian or Pahlavi, you know, middle, you know, is ultimately related to English. You know, so
there's something in past year in the New York Times about a group, I think, in Texas that follow Zoroastrian rituals.
There's still some around. They're called Parsis or Farsis. Yeah, they're still around. They expose their dead to vultures and stuff like that. Yeah. Sometime around there, I don't remember the date exactly. That's further north. That was an earthquake, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You sure it was a war?
They wanted to protect from the aspects of the
Okay. So I have to check. I don't remember offhand. It's a good question. No, that's different. I mean, that's when you have two contemporaries who are both on the highest level of scholarship, that's what happens. You know, I mean, you have this all the time. You know, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yishmael. You know, everybody. You know, there's almost nobody who is there alone. Like, you never hear anybody disagreeing with him. I mean, that's I don't know if I should use Yiddish, but you know, fourth is the mensch. That's the way people are. You say nay, I'll say. You know, the people have different natures and so on. As a matter of fact, we will talk about this maybe a little later. The question of where do opinions come from? Because there is a feeling, more than a feeling, there's a dogma in at least Ashkenazi yeshivot that nobody ever had an original thought. You know, and of course the idea is that you are not allowed to have an original thought either. You know, because after all, they didn't, then who are you to have an original thought? And so the idea is that every machloket really is not a machloket that, you know, somebody, chas v'shalom, ever had an original thought. These are all, you know, they come from generations, they're masorot. But of course, the question, who was the original? You know, where did the machloket originate? We will see that once we start looking and seeing what people say and keep track of what they say, they have shitot, they do have thoughts and they have general approaches. And it it's only if you totally ignore tremendous amount of data that you can say what people say. Now, Shmuel's support, for the Persian regime can be shown in some other ways. For example, very quickly, because I want to go on to other things. Brachot here, you have a report of a conversation that he had with Shapur, at the top of page 2. Amor le Shabur Malchel and Shmuel. So he said, "Amritu the Chachmitu Tuva." He said, "You claim great wisdom for the Jews. So if so, Emily my Chazena Bechel my. Tell me what I'm going to dream tonight. If you're so smart, you know, tell me what I'm going to dream tonight." It's interesting, you know. These days we say, "If you're so smart, tell me what the stock market is going to do tomorrow." But you know, he wanted to know what he was going to dream because he already had the money, so I guess he didn't care. So Amalei, so Shmuel was totally equal to this question. He said, "Chazit da aturomai v'shavulach v'tachti mach tashiyata b'rechaya d'davah." You're going to see that the Romans are going to come, and they're going to capture you, and they're going to make you ground date pits in a golden grinder. Okay, so I mean, you're talking about the arch enemy is going to come. And he's going to capture you and make you do this demeaning labor. So the Gemara says, he thought about it all day. I mean, this is something you know, You know, if Newt Gingrich is told that Clinton is going to win in 1996, and there's no question about it, and he will no longer be speaker, he will think about it too. So, and Ula Orta Hazah, and that night he had that dream. Okay, and you understand why he had that dream. But meanwhile, you know, Shmuel knew how to handle it. But what we learned historically is they had this conversation, that they were on these terms that they could have such a conversation. That doesn't mean they had to be bosom buddies. But they could, you know, he had enough access to him, you know, that he could have this kind of, discussion. I assume, for example, when the Maharal met Rudolf II in 1602, that was the kind of, discussion they had also. So, and now, his support for the regime went even further, because we have a more... Lo amru, that you should not, the din, the halakha, that you should tear as a sign of mourning, is only barov tzibur, when most of the community is affected, ucha ma'aseh shahaya, in a certain ma'aseh there, but not in general. So then the Gemara asks, mi ketal shavur malchay Yudai, did Shapur kill Jews? And didn't he once say to Shmuel, and again here we have another conversation that Shapur had with Shmuel, Haiti Lee, should I be damned, the Lokatli Yehudai Me'olam, I never killed Jews. So I'll be damned if I ever killed Jews, meaning I never killed Jews. So we say that, we see Shapur himself, said that he never had done it. So there, the Gemara concludes, Hana Inhu, Hatam Inhu Garmi L'Nafshayu, they caused it to themselves. Damar Rabbi Ami Lakal Yetere de Mizigat Kesari Pakash Sharada Ludvika. He says that because of the sound of the harp strings of Kesaria, the wall of the Doshians was burst. In other words, meaning that somehow or other they got involved in politics, and they got involved in anti-Persian politics. And Shapur did what he had to do, purely not because they were Jews, but because they were rebels, and therefore Shmuel refused to mourn them. Okay. Well, but the point is, you're not going to tell your ruler that, and you're representing the Jewish community, when he has to do something like that, you're not going to make a big issue of it. Because, it was not anti-Semitism, it was politics. Okay, and so he didn't, he kept quiet. Okay, now that we know some dates, and there's one other date we're going to get in, as we go through it, I want to take a look at a very interesting sugya in Bava Kamet 117 A and B. It's a kind of long sugya, but it's an interesting story, and once you strip away certain layers, as we'll see, it becomes even more interesting. Here's the story. You have somebody who wanted to go to the Persian IRS and report on somebody's income. He was a moser, and so Rav Kahana, who was a talmid of Rav, wanted to know if he were allowed to kill such a person. And Rav said, "Absolutely, that's mitzvah." And he killed him. So let's see what happens. There was a certain person who wanted to tell about the straw of his fellow Jew, meaning he wanted to report him to the Persian IRS. Atala kamei de Rav, he came before Rav, and this person who wanted to report to the Persian IRS said, asked him, "Should I do it?" And Rav said, "Amalei lo techavei velo techavei. Absolutely, you're not allowed to do this. Do not report this, your neighbor's straw to the Persian IRS." The guy says, well, they don't say exactly what his motives were. Let's say, "I hate his guts, I'm going to report him, and I'm going to report him. Mechavena, mechavena, I'm going to report him. I don't care what you say." Okay. So, the guy was stupid. If you're going to do it at least quietly. Don't go to Rav and ask a shot.
Right, exactly.
But, obviously, Sinam kalkelet hashura. If you hate somebody, sometimes you don't do it the right way. which is good, of course, you know. So Yatev Rav Kahana Kamei de Rav, so Rav Kahana was sitting before Rav, meaning as a Talmid, he was learning, he was studying with Rav. So Shamte Lekoe Minei, so he throttled him, you know. How they got rid of the body, we don't know, but you know. So Kare Ravi Luye Banecha Ufu Shafu Rosh Kol Kutzot Kedom Kedom Mitvar Mechmar. He made a drashan, the pasuk that says that if you, you know, that the goyim, once they have a chance to get Jewish money, they have no pity, and so he did a good thing. Kaven shenafal b'mitvar ein merachamim alav af mamon shel Yisrael ma'akav and so on. Kaven shenafal b'yad ovdei kochavim ein merachamim alav. So you did the right things, but the right thing. But now you got a problem. Now you have a murder rap. You know, what are you going to do? We're going to, you know, you did the right thing, but meanwhile we got to do something for you, so you're not going to get, get punished for it. And here's where what I said about the historical background becomes important, because now look at what the Gemara says. He says, Ad ha'idna, until now have a parsai lokapti ashvichut damim. Who were Persians, meaning Parthians, Arsacids, who didn't care about murder. Not that they didn't care about murder, they didn't care what Jews did internally, or the Christians did internally. A Jew could kill a Jew could kill a Christian kill a Christian kill another Christian. They didn't care about. You took care of that. Okay? If you killed a Persian, that's something else. But other than that, you know, you take care of it. That's your business. But now, that's up until now. Vahashta, but now, Ika Yevanai, which means it means Greeks, but it means the new regime, the Sasanians, the kaptu ashvichut damim, that are makpid, they worry about shvichut damim, even if it's internal Jewish shvichut damim, because here you have one Jew killing another Jew, they care about it. Why? Because they're meddling in internal Jewish affairs, as we know, from Persian sources, and the Amre, and they say mardin. Question of what it means, but if it's a Pechlevi word, if it's a Persian word, it means murder, right? You see? More than, right, exactly. And that's, by the way, murder. We're talking about languages that are related. English and Persian are related. So they're going to yell murder, meaning they're going to go after you. So we got to do something for you. We got to get you out of the way. Kum sakla arad Yisrael. So what's the way? You go to Eretz Yisrael. They don't have it. After all, the Romans don't have an extradition treaty with the Persians. So you go there, and where will you go? You go to Rabbi Yochanan's Beit Midrash in Tiberia. You go to his yeshiva there, and the Kabel Allah, and this is very strange because we don't find this kind of a Neitzah anywhere else in Chazal, in what we call classical rabbinic literature, you know, Babli, Yerushalmi, and Midrashim, and so on. We don't find this kind of a Neitzah. He says, you should accept upon yourself the Lo Takshi the Rabbi Yochanan Shvashnin. You will not ask a question, meaning you won't ask a kushya. You know, you won't bring a problem. You won't object to anything that Rabbi Yochanan says for 7 years. Okay, that will be, let's say, your kapara. You know, that you murdered somebody. That for 7 years, even though you're one of my outstanding students, you're not going to shine in Rabbi Yochanan's yeshiva. You're going to be a backbencher there. You're going to keep your mouth shut. You may get 100 on the midterm and 100 on the final. But class participation is going to be zero from you. You know, you keep them on. So Rafka, yeah. Excuse me. Well, tell me, give me an alternative explanation. Let's say that. However, you'll see from the continuation of the story that was probably not the foremost motive, because you'll see that Rav Kahana, when it comes to the clutch, boy does he open his mouth. So if he was worried about that, he probably wouldn't have opened his mouth as you'll see at the point that he did. So Azel Ashkeche L'Reish Lakish. Now Reish Lakish was Rabbi Yochanan's brother-in-law, and is also his one of his big, you know, his great Talmidim, and he was a Talmid Haver. He was both a student of his, and also his equal. They could dispute, and the Beit Midrash was very lively, because the two of them were always battling. So he was one of the mainstays of the yeshiva. Rabbi Yochanan was a Rosh yeshiva, but he was, Rish Lakish, or Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish was also one of the big names there. And so Rav Kahana comes to Eretz Yisrael, he comes to Tveria, he comes to this yeshiva, and he finds Rish Lakish the Yatev v'kamisayeh misifta the Yomad l'Rabbanan. He sees that Rish Lakish is reviewing the day's shiur with the Rabbanan, meaning the Bnei HaYeshiva, with the students of the yeshiva. And we're not talking about a yeshiva Tanah here, we're talking about a kolel, like these days. So, Amalahu Reish Lakish Hecha, so they ask Reish Lakish, knew what's going on here. So, Amalu Amai, so in other words, Rav Kahana starts talking. So, Amalu Hai Kushiva, Hai Peroka, Hai Peroka. He gave him this question, and this answer. Rav Kahana showed that he was really somebody. Okay. But remember, Rav told him, keep your mouth shut. So in other words, but keep your mouth shut where? Keep your mouth shut with Rabbi Yochanan, who is the Rosh Yeshiva. So when Rabbi Yochanan gives his shiur, you keep your mouth shut. But over here, he didn't feel he had to keep his mouth shut. See, that's another reason why it's probably not that the Romans were going to hear about him. So Amr Leila Reish Lakish, so they told Reish Lakish, Azal Reish Lakish, Amr Leila Rabbi Yochanan, so Reish Lakish went and told Rabbi Yochanan, Ari Alami Bavel, a lion has come up from Bavel, a big Talmid Chacham has come up from Bavel, you better be careful, make sure you know tomorrow Shiur very well, because otherwise he's going to give you trouble.
The Ari is Reish Lakish, right?
No, the Ari is Rav Kahana. So, la'ayin mar b'misifta d'lemachar, be very careful, you really make sure you know this issue. And of course, as a brother-in-law, you can give him this good advice. So what happens, the next day comes, and everybody's ready for this big blowout battle between Rav Kahana and Rabbi Yochanan. But meanwhile, of course, we know that Rav Kahana is supposed to keep his mouth shut. So what happens? So remember, he's already, the day before, he already showed his power. So he's going to be put front and center. He's put in a prominent position in the yeshiva. So l'machar, the next day, the day of the shayur, otuvua b'dara kama kama de Rabbi Yochanan. He was put, as I said, in the front row, front and center, right before Rabbi Yochanan, and everybody was waiting to really see this battle. The fireworks between the two of them. So what happens? What happens is, Amash matata v'lo achshu. Rabbi Yochanan said a halacha. Doesn't ask a question. Shmatata v'lo achshu. Once again, Rabbi Yochanan gives a halacha, and Rav Kahana is quiet. So I mean, remember he got his front row seat because he was supposed to show something. He was supposed to perform. He didn't perform. So they put him down back seven rows to the back benches, because after all, I mean, he might as well be sitting there. It's not what's worth he doing sitting in front. He keeps his mouth shut. He has nothing to say. You keep him in the back benches. So note already that here you have a description of the yeshiva in Tveria as having seven rows. Keep that in mind. So Rabbi Yochanan says to Reish Lakish, he says, you told me I got to be very careful, and he says, Ari, you said a lion came up from Bavel, so he says, Ari shamarta nasa shual. This lion that you said became a fox. He's too smart to start up with me. He knows when he can start up with you, he can start up with the Bnei Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva is something else. But meanwhile, let him stay there on the back benches, because that's where he belongs. So when Rav Kahana heard this, Rav Kahana says to himself, Yehei Rava, it should be God's will, Yehi Ratzon. Da'anei Shvad Darei Levu Chiluf Shvad Shinin Damali Rav. These seven rows, he says, this shame that I just endured to be pushed back seven rows should be instead of the 7 years that Rav told me to keep quiet. Okay, the kapara that I'm going to get for being quiet for 7 years, I have just endured that by being pushed back seven rows. 1, 2, 3. Not 7 rows. Okay. Okay. So now he says, all right, let's get down to business. So Kamakare, he gets up on his feet and he says, Nehada Mabaresha, let the master begin the shir from the start. Okay, I was quiet up until now. Now I'm not going to be quiet. Okay, I mean, you have to allow a certain poetic license here. I mean, can you imagine, you know, after you've been set back seven rows and, you know, suddenly get up and you're going to make demands on the Rosh Yeshiva, already it comes a little, we'll see, there's more than that when it comes to kind of grotesque elements in the story. But it makes for a nice story anyway, the big drama. He gets up and says, come on, start over again. Okay. So, Amash Matatav Ashi. This time it's different. This time Rabbi Yochanan says a halacha, and Rav Kahana asks him a question. And this keeps happening until Ukmei Bidara Kama. He finally wins his way back to the front row. But goes further than that. Because Amashmata Taviakshi, after he's on the front row again, and of course we're talking about, he asks a question that Rabbi Yochanan can't answer. That's the whole point here. In other words, if he answers it, that doesn't count. What counts is, Nitzuchashel Torah, that he manages to ask an iron question, as they say, so that, you know, that Rabbi Yochanan can't answer. So, what happens when Rabbi Yochanan, after he gets back to the front row, Rabbi Yochanan still can't answer the next question? So the Gemara has a very interesting, what happens is, Rabbi Yochanan havayatev ashva bistriki. Rabbi Yochanan was sitting on seven mats. And we know very well, and we have pictures. As a matter of fact, I'm sorry, I meant to bring in a picture of what happens if the Persian king wanted to honor somebody who was coming for an audience. He would sit him on mats. And the more mats you got, the greater the honor. That was the custom of the Persian court. And here it's being described that way also, that Rabbi Yochanan, as the Rosh Yeshiva, was sitting on seven mats. And every time he couldn't answer a question that Rav Kahana posed to him, he lost the mat. Okay. So shafle chad bistrika mitote. So they took one mat off when he couldn't answer a question. And again, amash matatavi akshile v'lo'at shafle kulu bistrika mitote. And what happened is, this kept happening until Rabbi Yochanan lost his seven mats. He was sitting on the ground. Adi Yatev al Ara. Rabbi Yochanan was on the ground, and I guess Rav Kahana was on the seven mats. You know, he was sitting in front row center with the seven mats. Now what happens? Rabbi Yochanan Gavra Savahava, the Mesarche Givine. Rabbi Yochanan was a very old man, and his eyelids were wrinkled and down over his eyes. So it was he couldn't see, and the muscles had apparently atrophied, and he couldn't raise his eyes himself. This too is a very interesting theme. We don't find it anywhere in Jewish literature. We do find it in Persian literature. This theme of a person who's very old not being able to open his eyes himself. Okay, so what happens is, Amar Lahu, so he said to the Talmidim, Deluli Einai, sorry about that. And I have the achziyeh. Pull up my eyelids so I can see Rav Kahana, who shamed me. Okay, or at least to see, you know, this great Talmid Chacham. Okay. And it says, the lulei b'machalta de kaspa. They used a bluing stick. You know, they used to put blue on their eyes for refuah. So, but the point is, almost like a thin lipstick type thing. But anyway, they used one of these things made out of silver, very important also, a silver one, not a golden one, and they raised his eyelids so that he could see Rav Kahana.
Excuse me, I think
there
was a condition called ptosis, P-T-O-S-I-S, where the eyelids are too long or something like that.
Yeah, but here we're talking about it's pure age, it's only age. Now, let's do a little figuring. Yeah. But when he's low, okay. Yeah, but the point is, that's a good point. But meanwhile, he still can't, you'll notice, he can't raise his eyes, because ordinarily, he would, you know, you would expect him to be able to just, you know, open his eyes wider. Oh, okay, all right. Okay. That's possible. But remember, Right, but please note something. Here, it's attributed to the fact, not that he had ptosis, but because he was an old man. And that's the Persian theme. Right. Now, let's take a... Right, now, oh, okay, that may be. You're telling me, oh, okay, fine. Now we know. See, this is Realia. Now we know what disease this story tells us Rabbi Elkanah was suffering from, if he was indeed suffering from this disease. Another date. Yeah, right, that's, well, no, out of respect, you know, other people do this kind of thing for you. Rabbi Elkanah died in 279. Okay. Now, let's do a little figuring here. Rabbi Yochanan died in 279. Presumably, let's say he died at the age of 90. Now, there is a tradition that says he lived for 400 years. It's been suggested that 400 years comes about because somebody saw a Tav, 400, which is an abbreviated way of writing Tishim, 90. You know, and he lived, you know. I'm assuming that he did not live for 400 years. And if he did live for 400 years, well, what can I tell you? Now, let's do a little figuring here. 226, the Sasanians come in. Somewhere between 226 and 248, when Rav died, this incident occurred. Right? Because Rav is the one who told Rav Kahana to go to Eretz Israel. So it had to happen before 248. But on the other hand, it talks about the change of regime as being relatively recent, and that was in 226. So let's say this happened in the mid-230s. Okay. The mid-230s. Let's say it even happened in 239, just to make the calculation easier. So therefore, Rabbi Yochanan, who died in 279, in 239 was about 50 years old, if he died at the age of 90. Okay. So he was about 50 years old, not exactly what you would expect to be a very old man who is so old that he's suffering from ptosis. Okay. Excuse me? Right after, on the next page, you will see the Palestinian version, the Eretz Yisrael version of this story. We will talk about that. S-A-S-S-A-N-I-A-N. Sassanian. No, then why not? Here. For good measure, I'll give you the Parthians also. And I'll also give you the dynasty, the Arsacid. Okay? So, I'll stand here so you see the blackboard for 2 minutes. Okay. So, I also am out of range of the... Alright, well, I guess it's not fair then. Now, notice also, okay, we have the mats, and bistriki is clearly a Persian word. The whole idea of mats as a sign of honor is a Persian idea. The business of old people not being able to raise their own eyelids is a Persian idea. Again, as I said, you find it in Persian literature, you don't find it anywhere else. More than that, under the Sasanian regime, even though gold was worth more, silver was the more honorable metal. Okay, it's not without significance that Rabbi Yochanan's eyelid is being raised by a machpelta of silver and not of gold. So you have all these Sasanian elements. More than that. We know something about the yeshivot in Babel and the yeshivot in Eretz Israel. The yeshivot in Eretz Israel were not arranged the way they were in Babel. There were three rows and not seven rows. They all had 70 major Talmidim, but they were distributed differently. In Babel there were seven rows, in Eretz Israel there were three rows. So what you have here is a story, a very well-told, dramatic story that is full of Persian motifs and Babylonian motifs, transferred to an Eretz Israel background. Okay, But we know that these are Persian motifs. We all also know that Rabbi Yochanan could not have been so old when this occurred, because we know, as I said, the regime changed in 226. We know that Rav was Niftar in 248. We know Rabbi Yochanan was Niftar in 279.
No, it could be 7 years.
That, right, exactly. Not in Eretz Yisrael, not in Tiberia. So, now what happens? So now, remember, to go back to the story, they've just raised Rabbi Yochanan's eyelids, and Chaza de Pratei Siptate. He sees that Rav Kahane was smirking. His lips were kind of, broken, In other words, he seemed to have a smirk on his face. So in other words, here he's humiliated me before my own Talmidim, and he's smirking yet too. I mean, that's really too much to take. So Savar Achuch Kemachayek Vei. So Rabbi Yochanan thought that Rav Kahane was smirking at him. Okay, he thought he was being so disrespectful. So Chalash Date, he had this Chalishut Dat, he felt terrible. And as we know from other places in Shas, that when Rabbi Yochanan felt terrible and he looked at you, you better get out of his sight, because you died. There were a number of stories of that sort, and that's what happened here. Chalash Date, Rabbi Yochanan felt terrible. Benach Nafshei, Rav Kahane died. It's kind of ESP. Or just the power of a Talmid Chacham. So Lamachar Maluhu. So the next day, Rabbi Yochanan said, "Now you know how to treat a Talmid Chacham." The next day, Rabbi Yochanan said to Rabbi Yochanan, "Amalu Rabbi Yochanan Rabbanan." Rabbi Yochanan said to the Rabbanan, "There's a colon that doesn't belong." Chazitu the Bavla Hechi Avid. Did you see how that Babylonian treated me yesterday? What a chutzpah! Can you imagine? Amulei, they said to him, Darkei Hafi. That's his expression. That's not, he wasn't smirking. That's his set expression. He has a split lip, whatever it is, that's just the way, that's the way he looks. He wasn't, if you had seen him 10 minutes before, it would have been the same expression. 2 hours before, it would have been the same. So now Rabbi Yochanan really felt bad. Because here he thought he was smirking at him, and and this happened, and he deserves it. But now he didn't deserve it. So, al gabe ma'arta, so he went to the burial cave to ask mechila, to ask forgiveness from Rav Kahane for this incident. So, chaza dahava hadr le'achna, he saw there was a serpent curled around the entrance of the burial cave. Amalei, so he said, Achna, achna, p'tach kumech v'kanes harav etzel ha-talmid. It says, serpent, serpent, open your mouth, because apparently his tail was in his mouth, and he was curled around the entrance to the cave, and you couldn't get through. Open your mouth, and let the Rav enter and visit the Talmid, to ask, for mechila. Lo patach, and the snake did not open his mouth, didn't allow Rabbi Yochanan to come into the burial cave. So then he said, Yikanes chaver etzel chaver, let one colleague come in to visit another colleague. The lo patach. Didn't open. So then finally he has to humiliate himself even further. He says, Yikanes talmid etzel harav, let a student enter to visit the rav. Patachle. Then the serpent let him in. Ba'ai rachame, he asked for mercy, meaning he was mitpalel, he prayed to God that Rav Kahane should be resurrected and brought back to life. Gukme, and he resurrected him. Rav Kahane came back to life. Amale, so Rabbi Yochanan tells Rav Kahane, listen, I'm sorry. He says, Yihav yedane dedake demar hachi lo chalshe datai. He said, if I had known that this was your set expression, I wouldn't have had this chalishut hadat, I wouldn't have felt so bad, and you wouldn't have died. So now that I know, so it's not going to happen again. Hashta leitim ma'badan. Says, now you come back to the yeshiva and learn, everything will be okay. So Amalei, so Rav Kahane says, not so fast. Imatzit min mabai rachmei detulo shtev nazelni. He says, if you can be mitpalel that I will not die again, okay, I'll come back. But be la zelna. But if not, I'm not going to come back. You know, not you know, I'm not going to put myself through this again. So, hoel v'chalif shata, chalif tayres. Once the hour had passed, the turn had passed, meaning he wasn't going to go back to the yeshiva. And ukme shaylei kof sveke da havelei upashtinu niale. Hainu dama Rabbi Yochanan de lachon amri de lachon hi. And then Rabbi Yochanan asked Rav Kahana, who had shown that he's his master in halacha, all the doubts and the questions that he had, and Rav Kahana answered them. And that's what Rabbi Yochanan says, that yours is our, is theirs, meaning that the Torah of Eretz Yisrael is really the Torah of Babel. Now, let's
mean that they would accept the people of Babel.
Yeah, right, exactly. Which is not too likely that Rabbi Yochanan, you have to know something about Rabbi Yochanan. We have a lot of reports about Rabbi Yochanan, both in the Bavli and in the Yerushalmi, and Rabbi Yochanan had very little use for Bavli. And the Bavli knew that. As a matter of fact, there's a famous Gemara in Sanhedrin Kaf Aleph where Rabbi Yochanan says, Hane Bavlai Tipshai, these foolish Babylonians. It says a few times, but the Atev Yara the Hashok, who live in a land of darkness, their Torah is also dark. And there's a lot of expressions like that. For example, in Yuvah Gimel, where they talk, the Mishnah talks about Alexandrian Kohanim who had healthy appetites, and Erev Yom Kippur they would eat the meat from the Korbanot. And the Bavli says they were not Alexandrians, they were Babylonians. And why does the Mishnah call them Alexandrians? Because they hate Babylonians. Okay, this is well known. This is, you know, you can fill in the ethnic group of your choice, you know, the way, you know, however, you know, Hungarians and whatever, you know, Galicianas and so on and so forth, you know, you can fill in, you know, I'm not going to, you know, they did not like each other. As a matter of fact, there's one case where Rabbi Yirmiyah, who was a Bavli, who came to Eretz Yisrael and stayed there, and then started talking about his former countrymen in the same terms that as Rabbi Yochanan was talking about them. And the Bavli in one place says that when he was here, he didn't know what the Rabbanan, meaning the Bnei Yeshiva, said. Now he calls us foolish Babylonians. Okay. So,
would you say in general that those from the Talmud Yerushalmi had contempt for those from the Talmud Bavli in general?
In general. A lot of people, anyway. Rabbi Reish Lakish, who's Rabbi Yochanan's brother-in-law, says, "I hate you, Babylonians." I mean, this is a quote, direct quote. According to the Rambam, it's much more complicated than that. But yeah, according to the Rambam, yeah. No, but he's not. He's known. He's not unknown. And as I said, Rashi. In Baba Kama, and if you as you see later, right in the next paragraph, the Yerushalmi reports Rav Kahana's visit to Eretz Yisrael, and he's occasionally, yeah. Although it's hard to tell because there are at least three or four Amoraim named Rav Kahana, and it's hard to know which one. So it's not clear that he was. Clearly, he was not regarded in the way this story tells. Now, there's one of the most important, if not the most important manuscript that we have of any Masechta or Masechtot of the Bavli is what's called Taviad Hamburg. It's a manuscript of the Bavli, not the Bavli, but the Babas, Baba Kama, Baba Siyah, and Baba Batra, that's found in the Hamburg Library. And even though it dates from the 14th century, the text that it contains clearly goes back centuries earlier. It's like the Geniza fragments that you may have heard of from the Cairo Geniza. And that does not have, and you see they were added afterwards in the margin and between the lines, and the text of this story that Taviad Hamburg has, these Persian elements are missing. The business of the mats and the business of the silver stick and all this stuff and the eyelids, all of this is not in that manuscript. What is in that manuscript is the seven rows. That is But all the other stuff is not there. So it's been suggested, among others, by Professor Sperber at Bar-Ilan and Professor Gaffney at Hebrew University, that both of them, by the way, are Shomrei Torah Mitzvot. I just want you to know. I know them both personally, and they're both wonderful people, aside from being Shomrei Torah Mitzvot. Unfortunately, we don't always go together, but I'm here, I'm paid for that. But on the other hand, this is something that everybody knows, unfortunately. But at any rate, they both suggested that these elements were added to the story later. Okay, in other words, and they come from a time during the Gaonic period, in the 9th century, let's say the 10th century, when there was, anybody ever hear of Pirkoi Ben Baboy, or Pirkoi Bar Baboy? Well, he was one of the people in Gaonic times who carried on an extensive propaganda in favor of the Bavli and against the Yerushalmi. Okay. So it's been suggested that these elements that make Rabbi Yochanan look less than the great Talmid Chacham that he was, and he clearly was, one of the reasons that the Rambam says that he's the one who put together the Yerushalmi is because he's just mentioned so often. And even in the Bavli, he's mentioned 3,000 times in the Bavli. We're talking about somebody who's got, you know, really one of the most important Talmidei Chachamim, and if we had time, I would point out so much of what we consider, you know, Yahadut, comes from, you know, the Shitot that he implanted and that he's, you know, that he pushed. You know, his influence on Yahadut from his time to our time is just absolutely immense. Absolutely immense, both in Halakha and in Hashkafa. Rabbi Yochanan, absolutely one of the most important figures in all of Jewish history. Absolutely. You know, beyond any doubt. That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm suggesting, as Professor Sperber and Gaffney have suggested, that these elements that make him look grotesque date from a time when people were trying to show the superiority of the Bavli over the Yerushalmi. Okay. Now, further to that, and as I said, Rashi mentions this, and here we have it here, and there's a similar story, clearly relating to the same incident, in the Yerushalmi. This is the Yerushalmi's version of what happened between Rabbi Yochanan and Rav Kahana. Pirkoi ben Baboy? Yeah. Now, I didn't say that he did, but somebody along, you know, somebody who... That's the whole point. In other words, he didn't know the dates exactly. He wasn't familiar with the chronology, but he added these elements to spice up the story and to make Rabbi Yochanan look a little more, grotesque, actually. You mean the right, but these are still, yeah, that's true. So that's an earlier version. But, you know, meanwhile, let's take a look at what the Yerushalmi reports, which doesn't have any of this at all. Yerushalmi has a report that, you know, I think, you know, we can see very easily. Kahana hava ulem sagin. It says, doesn't call him Rav Kahana. He didn't have smicha going for them. He was a young fellow, quite a young fellow. Not without talent, came to Eretz Yisrael, you know, to study. Katz like Lahacha when he came here. Chamte chad bar pachin, so one kind of prankster saw him, and apparently Rav Kahana, you know, was one of these people who was so immersed in learning that he just, you know, he walks around thinking in terms of learning, and he doesn't notice what's going on around him. He's very abstracted. So somebody in Eretz Yisrael, and remember, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, they were not the only ones. In Eretz Yisrael in general, Babylonians were not popular. Okay, so if somebody could score off a Babylonian, they would do that. So Amalei, so somebody saw him walking in the street, Makala Bishmaya, what are you here in heaven? You know, obviously you're not here on this earth. You know, your head is in the clouds. It's like saying your head is in the clouds. So, you know, Rav Kahana knew what you know how to answer back. We already saw that. Amalek Gzar Dinei Nahu Gavra Mipatim. It says, the Gzar Din, the decree of the death of this person who's just said this to me, is being sealed this very moment in heaven. You want to know what's happening in heaven? Your death warrant has just been signed. That's what's happening in heaven. The Chen Havatle, and that's what happened. This is the Yerushalmi telling the story. Some fellow in the street was making fun of Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana answered him right, and he died. Okay. Presumably he died because he was disrespectful to Rav Kahana. So, and this happened again. So he says to him, finally, says to himself, Ama masalekit mizakev ana echte. Masalekit lemiktele b'nei arad Yisrael. Says, I went up to be mizakeh all the people, to give them merit and to learn myself. I didn't come to Eretz Yisrael to kill out the whole population. You know, what's going on here? I see clearly things are not going well for me. You know, I may come out okay with these exchanges, but meanwhile, I'm killing people on right and left. That's not what I wanted. That's not what I came here for. Nezol v'nechot li min mahe nisleki. I'll go back from where I came up. You know, I'll go back to Babel because clearly I'm not making it here in Eretz Yisrael in the way that I would consider to be a proper way of making it. So Atala Gabe Rabbi Yochanan, he came to Rabbi Yochanan, and he said, Amalei bar nash de imei mevasrale v'itasei davui malmukrale lehen yezalei. He says, a person whose mother disrespects him, insults him, and his stepmother shows him respect, where should he go? And clearly what he means is, his stepmother is Babel, his mother is Eretz Yisrael, but his mother, Eretz Yisrael, is not showing him proper respect, while his stepmother, Babel, is showing him proper respect. So where should he go? So Rabbi Yochanan says, I'm like, Yezol lehen demokrin le, go where the person should go where he's shown respect, not where he's not shown respect. So in other words, he was saying, go back to Babel. That's how Rav Kahana took it. But of course, Rabbi Yochanan didn't know he didn't know the background of this question. So, Nechat Leikana Min Hendis Lake, he went back to Babel. He went from where he came back, came up. Aton Amrin Le, the Rabbi Yochanan, Hanachit Kana Le Babel. So they came, the Bnei Yeshiva came to Rabbi Yochanan to tell him, Rav Kahana has gone back, or Kahana has gone back to Babel. Rabbi Yochanan is wondering. He says, Ama Mahava Mezal Le, Below Meistav Rishukha. You know, even today, you know, if you leave yeshiva, you don't go without reshut. You have to ask permission of the Rosh Yeshiva to go to leave yeshiva. So how could he leave without asking me for permission to leave?
Even a Babylonian has to ask
permission. Of course. He was part of the yeshiva. You don't, you put yourself under the authority of your Rosh Yeshiva. That's absolutely, you know, that's very understandable. So Amin Le, so the student said to him, Ahum Bilted Amalat La, who have a Nitilat Reshut today? That question that he asked you, that was his asking permission. Okay. So here we have a different kind of the whole atmosphere of the story is very different.
He didn't die,
which we knew he died in Babel. So all of these elements that we found in the Babli version of the story are absent from the Eretz Yisrael version of the story. That too. But that may have been, you know, that may have been. By the way, if you look in the Achronim, you look at the Marsha and so on, he doesn't talk about this at all. You know, it's interesting, and this is one of the things I see we're beginning to run out of time, maybe more than beginning to run out of time. It's very interesting what the Achronim and Rishonim talk about, what they don't. There are a lot of these kinds of stories that they do not talk about. Why? Because clearly, you know, this is not the kind of thing you want to dwell on. You know, either you want to reinterpret it out of existence, right, or you ignore it. And of course, you know, in most yeshivot, you ignore it, meaning you skip Agadata anyway, and so you skip all these stories, and you don't know, you know, not everybody got along well with everybody else, and the Balaam didn't get along with the people there at Israel, and so on and so forth, but you know, you like to have a rosy picture of the past. But what I'm pointing out here is, and I actually have a lot more to say, but you know, unless I have Tilat Rishut from the people here to say it, I'll have to cut it short. What I want to point out here is, how did we get to the point that we're at, and understanding the story in its historical context? by knowing something about the historical context, two historical contexts. One is the historical context, and not just the historical context, but the cultural context, the condition of manuscript versions of the Babli and so on, and also a comparative approach, meaning you compare what the Yerushalmi says on the same thing the Babli says. All of these things helped us to understand, to unravel the different layers of the story as it's told in the Babli. That's one part of the history that we have to know. And the other part of the history we have to know is what happened later on after the Babli. In other words, in the course of the Babli's transmission, in Gaonic times, we had to know that there was, and there's a tremendous amount of documentation for this, there was a big dispute over which should be the supreme, the authoritative Talmud, Babli or Yerushalmi. And for a long time, for centuries, it was still a question. And Yerushalmi held sway not only in Eretz Yisrael, but let's say in Italy, in other words, in Jewish communities in the Roman Empire. It's only much later, in late Gaonic times, that the Babli started making headway, and eventually it made headway even in Eretz Yisrael, and of course eventually the Babli was superior, emerged superior, and if we had time, I would talk a little bit about why that is. It's very clear that it was almost inevitable that that would happen because of what Jewish communities needed, but whatever happened, happened. The point is, in order to understand this story, we have to know a number of things. We have to know, as I said, when Rabbi Yochanan was Niftar, when Rav was Niftar, when the Persian Empire, when the dynasty changed, the regime changed. We have to know something about where Persian language, Peplevi. We have to know something about Minhagim, in other words, this business of the mats, and so on. We have to know something about the way the yeshivot were organized. All of these are things that help us understand what's going on here. Because otherwise what you have is a very strange story, a very grotesque story, a story that absolutely does not reflect. It's true, we know that Rabbi Yochanan didn't like Babli, and we also know that he tended to be thin-skinned. There are a lot of stories of that, but this is a bit further than that. So, there's a political motive here. Now, there's another thing I wanted to say, and I don't have time to illustrate it. We've only gotten to page 3, and I have 6 pages of it. Sources here. I knew that I was putting in more than I'd have time for, but I still did it. The Babli gives us a tremendous amount of information, not the kind of information that we're talking about here, historical information, different kind of information. Who said what? And if you start looking at the Babli from that point of view, if you keep track as, with who said what, who did what, intellectually speaking, you can write a very, very interesting intellectual history of the Babli. Okay, in other words, you won't necessarily